Welcome to Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio as we visit with Melinda Myers, a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host. She's an author, columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience, and she's appeared on Garden Talk many, many times. She's written over 20 gardening books. She's re-released the second edition of Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plant, Maintain a Midwest Garden. So we'll talk with her about getting a jump start on the growing season. And of course, we'd love to hear from you as we move along. What gardening questions do you have? Join the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, good to have you back.
It's always great to chat with you and your listeners, Larry.
Are you busy right now?
Yes, it's still. I'm still busy making appearances and doing webinars, which I love because I always learn something when I talk to gardeners. And I was just outside checking my garden a few minutes earlier, and boy, a beautiful sunny day, at least down here in my neck of the woods. And long sleeve t-shirt weather, at least if you move briskly. So can't beat that.
You didn't take your soil thermometer out there with you, did you?
I did, because I was listening to you and Patty last week, and I thought, ooh, I better see what the temperature is, especially if we're talking jump-starting the season. So I took measurements near my house in an unmulched bed. It was when I did a lot of changes, didn't get it mulched, shame on me. And that was near the house, and that was about 50 degrees, a little further away, about 45. So I'm out in the country a little bit away from Milwaukee, about 20 miles southeast of Milwaukee, if that helps folks. So a soil thermometer is a cheap investment that tells you a lot about what's going on.
And you need 45 is a little cool to be
it is.
putting much
it is.
Into the soil.
It is. And one thing, you know, I think we think, okay, I know some of the garden centers in the area were getting calls when we had those 70, 60-degree days a month or so ago. When can we get our tomatoes? When can we get our impatiens? And luckily, they didn't sell them any because you'd be replacing them, obviously. And one, it's soil temperatures, you mentioned, Larry. And the other is air temperature. And boy, we've had such extremes this winter and spring that I think we need to keep that in mind as we're thinking about jump-starting the season. I think the USDA changes in the zone hardiness map had a lot of people thinking, okay, you know, I've moved up a half a zone, I can get started earlier. But that's about average minimum winter temperature. And we've had, you know, some extremes on both ends. And so a soil thermometer is great. Colorado State University, on my website, I have a tip on soil temperature influences when to plant and a link to Colorado State University's vegetable planting guide. And they give you some guidance about what vegetables you can plant based on soil temperature, minimum, optimum, and then, you know, for some things it just gets too hot midsummer, some of our greens. And so I found that a very helpful bit of information as you're planning your garden.
And, of course, go to melindamyers.com, and Melinda's last name is spelled M-Y-E-R-S, melindamyers.com, and you're going to find that information. And we'll have a link on our page as well, on the Larry Mueller Show page for that as well. Well, can we warm the soil up?
Yes. A few years ago, I had a client that was based out of the southern part of the state. And in January, they said, we'd like you to do a video on, you know, planting early, get the earliest tomato possible. And we need it by March. And I said, I'm in Wisconsin, so that's not happening. But we did have a break in the snow. I warmed the soil. I used clear plastic for several weeks, warmed the soil. You know, tomatoes, Colorado says 50 degrees. I'm more of a 60, 65 degrees soil temperature. So we left it covered for several weeks to a month. We got the temperature warmed, and then we provided covering for the plants, right? Because we could have that unexpected spring frost. We could have temperatures in the 40s, which won't kill your tomatoes, but does stunt them and damage them. And so I was able to boost my harvest. I harvested early July, which isn't, you know, that great of a reduction, but boy, when you want a red ripe tomato.
Yeah.
So prepping your soil, however you prepare your soil, warm it a little bit. A friend of mine, Ray Greiton, years ago, he would always warm his soil, then lightly cultivate to get rid of the annual weeds. Won't take care of quackgrass and bindweed. Lightly cultivate, plant, and then cover his plantings with row cover that let air, light, and water through, but keep the heat by the plants. And I use that all the time, not only to jumpstart the season, protect my plants from frost, but I love the birds, and I plant for them, and I don't want them eating my seeds, which they love to do, right? And so it speeds germination when you're planting seeds as well. You know, cooler temperatures, peas, green onions, asparagus and rhubarb, if you can get a hold of the plants, mid-April is usually a pretty good time, at least in the southern part of the state. I think some of our northern friends are going to have to wait for snowmelt and warmer temperatures. But those cool season vegetables, you can get started around the 40 degrees. You know, a little bit warmer, you'll get faster sprouting. With warm season things like beans, corn, we want the temperatures more in 50, 55, 60 degrees. Peppers, even after your tomatoes, they like it a little bit warmer even than your tomatoes.
And you want to be sure that there's not any kind of frost with the peppers.
Oh.
Well, with any of it, but especially the peppers, because you'll wind up with great plants and no fruit.
Exactly. And part of, you know, our season is short enough, and the last thing you want to do right is invest all this effort and have no good results. So, you know, gardeners, we're optimistic and a little crazy, but there is a limit.
Yeah, there is indeed. Well, listen, on those tomatoes, when you get the soil going and you started getting some tomatoes in July, earlier July, did you wind up with more tomatoes? I mean, people are always wanting to get more harvest with their tomatoes.
You bet. Yeah, and a couple things to do. When you plant your tomatoes, you have some choices how to manage them. So if you bought an early tomato and you stake it, you're going to have the earliest fruit, especially if you jumpstart the season. But you're going to have fewer fruit. And I have to be honest, my dad always staked his tomatoes. And every year I want to do one in honor of him, and I give up. I'm like, I just need to put a cage on it. It's too much work. I know I sound lazy. I'm going to say busy. And so that's one way to jumpstart it. But you're right, because you have a longer harvest, especially if you're using indeterminate tomatoes that grow flower fruit until the frost kills the top or you pinch them back, that can extend your season as well. And so you may want to get like a 4th of July or an early girl or some of the early varieties so that you can maybe focus some effort on getting an earlier harvest. And then it makes it easier to wait for some of those that are coming in a bit later.
I know most of us are obsessed with growing tomatoes, or many are, I should put it that. And the new science I'm getting, I heard something about red plastic and using plastic mulch and so forth.
Great, great point. Cornell University a few years ago found that the red reflected light and it increased productivity on tomatoes and peppers as well. And so using a red plastic mulch, I've had seen gardeners use like an old tablecloth they bought at some, you know, thrift store or something and use that. Now keep in mind that does hold the moisture, but it doesn't let rain through, so just kind of keep that in mind. The tomato boosters are also very handy. They're red, and they're designed that you could even put your cage through. They have holes set for that, little reservoir to hold the water. And I was a little skeptical, and somebody who designed them and introduced them years ago gave me a couple to try. And I have to tell you, I planted a few weeks later using those, and those plants caught up with the ones I had planted earlier. And I usually wait till things are pretty warm to plant my tomatoes or use row cover because I find I can always beat those people who start really early, right, and can't wait. I understand that. And so you're right. That red mulch is definitely, Cornell found, research-based, that it does boost your productivity.
We have a number of callers online. Let's take some calls. Peter in Elk, Wisconsin. Let's go to you first. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Larry. I'd like to know how I can keep the chipmunks from eating my strawberries once they become ripe.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. chipmunks, we love to look at them. They're cute, but they sure do like to destroy hanging baskets, containers, and eat our fruit. So a couple things. You maybe tried using some shelter. Unfortunately, they are diggers, so they can go underneath if you cover them with hardware cloth or some type of wire basket. That's one option. I work with a company called PlantSkid, so I always like to, you know, let you know that. But it's Plant, S-K-Y-D-D, and it is labeled for chipmunks and squirrels, and I have used it. Now, ground squirrels are omnivores, and they eat a variety of things. So I've had some success using PlantSkid against ground squirrels. They're the ones that have a longer body, and when they run, their tails down. And chipmunks have a shorter body, and their tails usually up as they scurry around the garden and run. So, you know, you may want to put a granular application around the garden. You can spray the plants, but not the fruit. It's organic, but it doesn't taste too good. But you might want to give that a try if you've tried barriers and things like that and not having success. And we all know they're not afraid of us. So noise, you know, clanging pans, noise, that doesn't really work. They just kind of look at us like we're fools and keep eating. So you might want to give that a try, Peter.
Give it a shot, Peter. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Shirley in Narango next. Hi, Shirley.
Oh, good morning. I have a question regarding my ground flocks. I'm scoping the gardens out, and I have patches that are completely brown. I'm wondering if those will recover, or do I cut them back to the ground and new growth will come, or are they a lost cause?
You know, thank you for asking this question. I think we're going to see a lot of interesting results with this fluctuating temperatures we've had where plants started growing early and then we had some cold. Now, creeping flocks are the, I'm guessing that's what you're talking about, the low-growing, creeping across the ground, ground cover flocks. They like good drainage and full sun. So depending on the kind of moisture you've had this spring, hopefully there's no problem with root rot. If it's brown, it's dead. They will remain evergreen some years, but it won't hurt to cut them back. I would wait. One of the things I've discovered, when we have crazy winter temperatures, depending on our spring weather, sometimes the plants take a little longer to come out of dormancy, and I'm one of those people that will wait just so I can tell you if it works. So I wouldn't, you know, you may want to dig up a small piece, see if the roots are looking okay and intact. Otherwise, I would cut it back and then just wait and see what happens. If you're anxious and don't want to take a chance, you could dig up what's dead. But I think there's a good chance. It's pretty hardy. It's like zone 3 hardy. So I think you have a good chance of it coming back.
There you go, Shirley. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Seal in Menominee next. Hi, Seal.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can.
Okay, great. I just have a quick question. I just bought a new forsythia shrub, and I was just wondering if it was too soon or okay to get it in the ground, and I can get your answer off the phone and let other people.
Yeah, so, and you're in Menominee.
Correct.
Okay.
So great question. So here's the deal when we're looking at trees and shrubs and even perennials. It depends on what stage of growth they're in. So if they're as dormant as the plants in your garden, yes, you could put them out. If they came from a greenhouse or a high tunnel where they've already started to grow and the leaves are coming out and they're more advanced, that's kind of a sign. You know, kind of look at how they've been managed up until this point. So like field-grown perennials or perennials in pots that have been exposed to the same growing conditions as those in your garden at the same stage of development, they're great. But we also have to harden off things that may have been in like a high tunnel or a Quonset hut or a greenhouse because they've been really protected. And so we have to gradually harden them off to get them ready. So what I like to do is if I'm buying plants that aren't really ready to go outside because the weather's so unpredictable, I have carts in my garage. We don't park in our garage, what can I say? and I have carts on wheels, and I put all my plants on there so I can roll them out when the weather's right, gradually introduce them, you know, sun for an hour, then 2 hours the next day, and then roll them back in when we have really cold temperatures. And I find it makes it easier. I met a woman who had an older woman who had an old pickup in a barn, and she just filled her pickup truck, the bed, with all her plants, and she'd pull it out in the sun for an hour back in the barn, and she did this till they were hardened off and ready for the garden. So, Seal, I'd kind of monitor, look at the growth, and then look at kind of the weather forecast, and, you know, you can't hurt anything by waiting either, other than your time to keep it protected and keep it exposed. You know, if it's starting to grow, you want sunlight during the day, but protected from those really chilly temperatures.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today, nationally known gardening expert. She's been with us on this program for many years, and it's always a pleasure to have her with us. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio and Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with Melinda Myers. Again, if you have a question, a gardening question for her, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Ione in Stockholm emailed. She recently got a hold of a bunch of old burlap seed bags and wonders if she can use them as a weed barrier in her garden. And if so, should she put straw over the top so it won't break down when she walks on it?
When I think of burlap, I think of it being very loose weave and potentially letting light through.
Yeah.
If you use it, I would do it in a layered, fashion. You do want it to break down, so I don't know if it's been treated. I don't know if the burlap for seed bags is treated at all. And so that would be my only concern. I'm guessing if they're old, probably not. But maybe use them on your pathway and then cover it with something else as opposed to around the plants. I just am hesitant that they'll be very effective. I appreciate that she wants to find another use for them instead of throwing them out. And so, you know, I don't know. Do you know anything about burlap, old burlap seed bags? I don't know.
I don't know what the, it depends if the seeds were treated. There could have been some.
Right. Residue.
Yeah. That's the only thing I know. We'll have to, maybe somebody from a seed bag company will call.
That would be great. I always count on your listeners when I'm stumped and yes. I just am a little hesitant when I don't know something for sure to say put it in the garden, especially if you're going to eat the, eat something from there. It's always better to be on the safe side.
Let's go to Pat in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Aloha, Larry, and hello, Melinda.
Hi.
Good to hear you today, and I'm writing down all your tips. I have marigold seeds that are in my refrigerator plus milkweed seeds. And I have the six compartment trays from last year's plants. So I've got a whole tray full of those. Can I use my fresh compost or should I mix it with any other product in order to start my seeds indoors?
Great question, Pat. Compost is a great material, but I would add something to provide some drainage. So either vermiculite or perlite, or if you can get a hold of rice hulls. I know I use a potting mix that uses rice hulls as its drainage material. It's an organic product instead of vermiculite or perlite. But I just think all you're going to need to do is add something for drainage. Monitor. Compost has great nutrients, but you know, with any of the seedlings, you're going to want once they start growing, just see what the leaves look like. If they're looking a little pale, and you know they're getting plenty of light, you may need to use a dilute solution of any, you know, flowering houseplant fertilizer or seed starting fertilizer, just to keep them going till you get them outside into the garden. But that's a great use of compost.
Yeah, absolutely, Pat. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Lucas in Jefferson, we'll go to you. Hi, Lucas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question was, I had 2 years ago a bumper crop of cucumbers I planted in my garden, and that was great. But last year I did the same exact thing, same exact spot with them, and for some reason I had, they would grow a little bit, and then they would shrivel back up, and very low, like, pollination rates and growth with them. So I basically got only, like, a handful. Wondering if you had any idea what was going on with that, and my initial thoughts was maybe not enough pollinators going around or something like that.
You know, you bring up a couple good points, and I'm glad you mentioned it, Lucas. With extreme heat, it impacts the pollen that many plants produce. So tomatoes and peppers are good examples, and so are cucumbers, that when we have high temperatures, sometimes the pollen is not as viable. When it's humid, sometimes the pollen is sticky, and so the pollinators are unable to move it as effectively. And what I found last year, it was really interesting. Some people had the best tomato and cucumber crops ever, and others had the same experience you did. And a lot of it, I think, was due to when your plant started flowering. You probably know, but for maybe new gardeners, cucumbers produce two different sets of flowers, male and female, same with melons. The first flush are all male, the second flush are female, and their timing has to occur, and that's where the heat can impact it so that you have a male for the pollen and the female to accept it so that you get pollination and fruit formation. So it's nothing you did wrong. It's just that, you know, we had an extremely hot summer last year, and one of the things you can do with cucumbers is you can stagger your plantings. Most of them ripen in about 60 days, so you could do, you know, plant something maybe mid to late May from seed, get it going, and then, you know, maybe in early July do another planting so that you increase your odds that you're going to get that pollination, both male and female flowers, at the same time in pollination. And, you know, pollinators are so critical. I was out in my garden the other day and saw lots of bee activity, a lot of native bees, even one bumblebee, visiting some of my hyacinths and even a couple of my more fragrant daffodils. And so, you know, having pollinating plants in your garden, one, it's pretty, and then two, that just is more, you know, better invitation for them to come and do their job for you. So you might want to boost your pollinator flowers and then do a couple of different plantings to try to increase the success of having flowers at the right temperatures.
Yeah, good points, Lucas. Thanks for calling. And Lucas is in Jefferson in the southern part of the state.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Probably 2 weeks later, maybe in the northern part of the state for getting cucumbers in.
Thank you so much for mentioning it. The Extension Service has a vegetable cultivar and planting guide. And granted, it hasn't been updated lately, but, you know, it never hurts to be a little conservative in your planting dates. And that has a whole list of when to plant. I also adapted it for my month-by-month gardening in Wisconsin and Minnesota book, so it's available. If you have that, take a look. It's in that publication as well. But you can, if you Google UWEX Vegetable Cultivar and Planting Guide, it's free to download on the Internet, and that might give you some guidance. And you're right, Larry. It talks about if you're in the southeast, if you're in the central, if you're in the northern, how to adapt to those dates.
Let's go to Faye in Milwaukee next. Hi, Faye.
Hello. I have ordered, I'm expecting them any soon, some bare root raspberries. I live on the east side. I have a small little garden patch, and I think I'll get like five of each. I'm not sure I'll fit them all in. But my question to you is I get five ever-bearing and five summer. Should I plant the same plant in each row, or should I alternate them? So should one row just be the ever-bearing and one be the summer, or do every other one?
I would put them in their separate rows, and here's the reason why, how you're going to manage them. So summer-bearing raspberries, they'll send up, you'll have those canes. Those first-year canes do not produce fruit. They'll go through the winter. Those canes at the second summer will produce fruit. And then we prune those back after they bear fruit because they're not going to have any more. It opens up your planting, better airflow, less risk of disease. Or worst case scenario, you prune out the ones that bore fruit in winter. Ever-bearing raspberries are so those first-year canes will have a set of fruit in the fall. That same cane overwinters and produces fruit in the summer. Now, some people decide to treat their ever-bearing as just fall-bearing because you'll get a bigger and earlier fall crop. And so if you, you know, cut it back after it bears fruit in the winter, you won't get a summer crop, but you'll have an earlier and bigger fall crop. And since you have summer raspberries, you may want to treat them so you'll get your summer crop, and then you'll get your fall crop on the other row. But however you manage them, it just might make easier pruning and maintenance by keeping them separate. And, you know, you can tell I worked for Extension for quite a while. They have a great publication on growing and training raspberries. And I recommend it because you're going to hang up and, like everybody else, you know, what did she say? We all do that, right? And so they have a nice diagram that shows exactly what I was talking about and more information. So you might want to check that out. And I just want to mention, Faye, with bare root plants, sometimes, depending on what's happened in shipment and how they were managed before you received them, if they've started growing, you've got to then harden them off before putting them outside. If they're truly dormant, you know, they probably come right from a cooler, you could put them out in the garden right away. But often I find sometimes bare root plants arrive with leaves on them, and we need to pot them up or give them that extra protection until we can, you know, get them hardened off and ready for the garden outside.
That's really good advice. Faye, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Marjorie and Muscadet, your turn. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi. How are you?
Great. What is on your mind?
Okay. I have a real simple question. So I had a young patch of asparagus, maybe 3 years old, and last summer in a fit of madness when all the fronds were going crazy, I cut them all down after the production of the asparagus. And someone then informed me, well, you're going to kill the plants if you do that. So now I purchased new asparagus plants, and I'm ready to put them in. And then someone said to me, oh, wait, they might come up. They might. So I don't know what to do.
So, Marjorie, hey, you know, did you cut when you said, so you harvested the spears, and then did you keep cutting the greens all summer so you never had any greenery at all last year?
Yes. I cut all the fronds.
In the summer, not in the fall?
In the summer, yep.
Okay. I'm surprised they didn't keep pushing out more green growth all summer because usually they'll just keep producing. Asparagus, if they're 3 years old, I'm with the person that said there's a good chance they're going to come back because you've got an established root system. Yes, you really would have liked to have left those greens intact until fall. I usually leave mine stand for winter, but if you have asparagus beetles, one way to manage them is to clean it up in the fall, and that removes their overwintering site. So you just were a little anxious to do the cleanup, I'm afraid. You know, if you have room to start another bed or plant another row with your new plants, I would wait because I find plants are more resilient than we often give them credit for. But this year, leave the greenery intact. Hey, everybody makes, you know, it's something new. Everybody makes mistakes. That's how we learn. And so then just leave those greens. I think they're coming back. I don't know. I don't know.
I'd put a little bit money on it.
I think so. Me too. So you'll have to call Larry and I if we're wrong. We're sorry. But I would try to just start another row with your new plants. There's never too much asparagus to have.
No, there is not.
So,
thanks, Marjorie.
Let us know. I hope it works for you, Marjorie.
Oh, boy. Lisa in Richland Center, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Melinda.
Hi.
In the next few weeks, I have some peonies I want to move off a property due to its being sold. It's currently in clay soil, and it'll be moving down into sandy soil. And I just want to know what my success rate could be or what I can do to make sure that they make it through and thrive later.
You know, I when I moved from the city, but I'd amended my soil for many years. I took my peonies that people bought my house, didn't want my plants, which was okay with me. And I'm now in sand country. So I've kind of had the same kind of deal. My soil was pretty well amended, and they've made the adjustment. And they actually sat in a pot a little longer than they should have for like a couple years. So I would say one of the ways to help that transition, if you dig them, And then if you can wash off the soil and then pot them up again, if you can't get them in the ground right away, that will help minimize the transition. I wouldn't scrub, you know, the rhizomes, but I would just kind of hose off some of the excess soil. They're going to adapt. It's just going to be a transition, as you're expecting, from that heavier soil to the sand. The surrounding soil is going to dry out faster. So you just want to be careful when you're getting them established. If you leave that clay soil intact, it's going to stay wet longer. So when you water, kind of check the moisture there, and then keep that sandy soil slightly moist so the roots start to explore beyond. But one option, just kind of gently wash off excess soil and get them in the planting spot where they're going to grow permanently, or pot them up in a well-drained potting mix, making that transition a little bit easier. But I think peonies are pretty tough, and I think you got a good chance of having them come through.
I agree. Lisa, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Colleen in Cumberland emailed. She wants to remake her till garden into a no-till regenerative garden this year. She had a cover crop on it last fall. It's now covered in black plastic to kill that off. Can you provide a few tips on no-till gardening?
Great. I think a lot of us we're finding out more and more about our soil and the importance of, you know, managing it differently than maybe in the past. Now, the advantage you had is you have been growing and tilling it. So sometimes converting heavy clay soil that hasn't been gardened into no-till can be challenging because the soil's so bad. But the fact you've been gardening on it, probably been adding organic matter, improving it, this is a great time to go no-till. Cover crops, excellent option. You can either do what you're doing, smother them and then till them in, or leave them dead, which is probably what you're doing as a no-till gardener. So killing them, leaving it dead, that serves as a mulch. So that's good. That dead layer serves as a mulch, and then planting in between. So that's a great way if you're totally eliminating tilling. Some people are doing cardboard, and which doesn't sound like what you're doing, but for others interested, cardboard and putting compost on top of that. There's a gentleman out of England that was doing that method. Now, the downside, I find, is where are you going to get enough compost if you're converting your whole garden? And you may need to either purchase some, making sure there's no jumping worms, or make more. But that's one way to do it. Or some people will just use the cardboard and mulch and then plant in between. Ruth Stout, years ago, back in the 70s, did deep mulching where she used just thick layers of straw and never tilled her garden. And she'd pull the mulch to the side and plant through it. Now, with heavy clay soil, for those with heavy clay soil, that stays cool longer. You know, I forgot to mention when I took the temperatures, I have sandy soil that warms up faster. If you have heavy clay and it's wet, we've had a lot of rain lately, it's going to take longer to warm up. So that can delay your plant growth. And then also some people talked about having issues with voles. I did a blog for Milorganite on no-till gardening and spelling out a lot of the different options. The other thing that, so hopefully I've given you advice on how to manage. So once you know you've killed those, that cover crop, I would just, you know, plant in between the dead plants, leave them intact. You could add mulch if you think you need to suppress the weeds. But one of the things I've been doing because of my sandy soil, and I don't have 26 years to build my soil like I did in Milwaukee, I've been doing a lot of lasagna gardening. And basically the idea is, you know, you edge out your bed. If it's in grass or weeds, put a layer of newspaper or cardboard, and then you basically compost 8 to 10 inches of green and brown material, sprinkle a little compost, some fertilizer, another 8 to 10 inches, until your bed's about 18 to 24 inches high. I planted, we did a video on it, and so, of course, I'm doing it in spring and wanted to plant, and I had great success, and even the following years. Now it's settled down, and it's even with the surrounding soil. So I'm kind of feeling I need to create some more lasagna gardens. And that's another way to do no-till. And if you have raised beds, it's a great way to create your own planting mix instead of buying in topsoil.
Those are all really good ideas. Very good ideas. Melinda Myers, our guest today. You can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers. Always great to have Melinda come be with us to talk about gardening. It's always a lot of fun. And we have some callers online, still in one open line, I think, at 800-642-1234. You can also email us to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Lynn in Sparta. Lynn, thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. So appreciate your program and your information. I have a question about an asparagus patch that's been established over 50 years. And, of course, because it's perennial, we have weeds that I don't till under. And so how to maintain that? Because after I pick the asparagus after the season is over, I leave things until the next spring. So a lot of weeds have an opportunity to grow.
Yeah.
Not my best gardening year. I was too busy, and I just cleaned up my asparagus patch, and I'm in the same boat you are in terms of the weeds. And so hand digging is probably the safest. Some people will use a total vegetation killer. The organics only burn the tops off. And, you know, asparagus, when it's starting to come through, if you accidentally hit the spear with, you know, if you use a total vegetation killer, you could damage that as well. I think, asparagus is wonderful, and it's relatively easy to grow, except for the weed issue. And so I would recommend, you know, I'm going to have to get out there and do some digging and keep after it, if I can keep after it, and then put down a layer of mulch. Shredded leaves work great. It's not going to keep the quack grass and the bindweed out. You're going to have to continue to pull that, but it will help with any of the annual weeds and seeds that are going to sprout and reduce it. So, unfortunately, I don't have an easy answer. And, you know, if you use the organic materials, it'll burn the tops, which may help slow things down, but you could do the same by just, you know, cutting it at ground level if you don't want to do any digging. And then digging carefully, right, so you don't damage the spears as well. So I have no good, easy solution. It's the price we pay for having asparagus, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Lynn, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dana in Milwaukee, on to you. Hi, Dana.
Hi. So glad to be able to join your program today. I have this garden, and I planted in it some plant. I don't know the exact name, but I think it's something like an anemone or a menemone or something. Is
it okay?
Beautiful white. Pardon?
Yeah,
yes,
anemone.
Sounds like anemone. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a beautiful white flower. Anyway, it's a rhizome, I think, and it is taking over everything. It's going into my yard. It has killed almost. It's overdone. It's almost everything else in the garden there has just died. It used to have beautiful astrolabes and stuff, and they've just been taking over this thing. And I am ready to get rid of it completely so that I can get back some plants. How do I deal with this? Because digging it out, I feel like I'd have to dig out my whole yard.
So is this a spring or a fall blooming anemone? When do you get your white flowers?
Fall
spring
bloom.
And fall.
Fall blooming.
It's probably one of the grape leaf anemones, which are beautiful because they bloom. They look like a spring plant, but yes, they are very vigorous. So the non-chemical option, especially if it's intermixed with good plants, is to dig out the individual plants. If you don't mind sacrificing that garden for a season, you may want to dig up your good plants. If there are a few of them, pot them up and then monitor to make sure you didn't take any bit of that rhizome, because the last thing you want to do is kill all the bad plants, and then replant some of the rhizome with your good plants back in the garden. So a non-chemical option would be to edge the garden bed, dig out your good plants, pot them up, cover it with clear plastic. Kansas State found like 6 to 8 weeks during the hottest part kills
the root system as well as the top. Smothering doesn't always work as well because it doesn't go down and kill the roots. If you don't mind using a chemical, one of your options could be doing the same thing and treating the whole bed, or protecting your good plants, if there are fewer of those, treating the plants as they emerge with a total vegetation killer, and then repeat as needed. And once it hits the soil, now this is a personal choice. Some people don't want to use Roundup. Finale is another different formulation that's a total vegetation killer. But that would kill the tops and the roots. And once it hits the soil, it won't be taken up by your good plants. I use like a milk jug. I try not to use a lot of chemicals in my garden, but I'll cut the bottom off, put it over my good plants. I've got a bad case of Crown Vetch. I'm giving up. I've not been able to manage it non-chemically, so the Roundup's coming out this year. We mowed it and did some stuff. But if you are at that point, that's another option. Always read the label directions before you even purchase, because sometimes people buy something, get it home, go, "Ooh, I'm not going to use that." Read it in the the garden center, and then read it before you apply. Those would be the two options. So you could dig, you could solarize, or you could spot treat with a total vegetation killer. But it's not going to be a short, as you probably already realize, it's not going to be a once and done, even with the chemical application. So good luck. They're beautiful, yeah. But I get it. They are aggressive.
Very aggressive. Dana, thank you for calling in. Good luck.
Yes.
Kathleen emailed that the rhubarb in her community garden in Milwaukee is getting too crowded. She'd like to divide her rhubarb. They have started sprouting about an inch out of the ground. Can she still dig and divide them? How close can she plant them in the plot?
Great question. Yeah, mine is even up. And actually, it looks pretty cool as those leaves are all curled and they look like little pods coming out of the ground. You read a lot, and a lot of people recommend dividing rhubarb in the fall, but I like to divide it in the spring. I just feel like if you can get it up and get it going, the sooner the better. And, you know, keep in mind how soon you want to divide it again. Rhubarb can stay in place for a long time. So look at the size of, you know, my rhubarb after about 10 years is probably about 3 feet in diameter. So you probably want to plant them that far apart if you don't want to be digging and dividing again. Closer together, they'll be fine. It just may be overcrowded, too. And I don't use a lot of rhubarb. I think it's a cool plant. I make a few things, so I usually have way more rhubarb than I need. So that's the other thing to think about. Do you have room in the community garden to spread it out a little further, give it plenty of room to grow, and be patient? And you're going to not want to harvest this year, obviously, when you're dividing. One option could be taking a chunk off the edge instead of digging the whole plant up. If you want to do that, leave one in place. But if you need to take the whole plant up, the bigger the division, the faster it will recover and fill in. So 2 to 3 feet, I think, should give you plenty of room. 3 feet will give you plenty of time before you ever have to remove it again or divide it.
We have an email from Josh. Last year, his cousin had voles eat up their potatoes while they were still in the ground. Wondering, what can she do to rid the garden of the vole issue?
Well, I feel like, you know, I'm treading into territory I probably shouldn't, other than as a gardener dealing with these same pest problems. So voles will go after fleshy roots. And if I remember from my visits with Scott Craven years ago, when the populations are high, they can be 400 to 1,000 per acre. And that kind of is on a four-year cycle. And so trapping, you know, using, he always recommended low-fat peanut butter, who wants to eat it, but the voles, and some oats, because, you know, they're seed eaters, but put it in a PVC pipe or a box so the birds don't go after it, and use a rat trap. But you're going to be hauling out a lot of voles. You know, sometimes if there's other food sources, they're less likely to go. I think with last year's heat and drought, I saw a lot more animal damage than I usually do, right? The other thing, I mentioned Plant Skid earlier, and it's actually labeled for use on against voles. And so that's another one that you might want to apply around your potato planting, and the smell to help get rid of that. It's hard to control voles. You know, you could try hot pepper sprays. You could try you know, boy, even if you put hardware cloth and buried it, they're just going to climb over. So you'd have to almost cage your potatoes. So hopefully the population is decreased. Hopefully they hit their peak and decreased and they found something else to eat. I don't know, Larry, you get a chance to visit with our wildlife specialist. If you have any other thoughts on this?
You've pretty well covered it, although I know some people, and I've actually tried this myself with the straw bale gardening. I had the straw that was left over from the year before was, you know, pretty decomposing. And you can make a kind of a roll. Take some wire and a screening device, but with big holes. And make a sort of a tower, and you can put the, it actually works.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You fill the tower up with the mulch, or the, in my case, it was the straw and some other things I threw in there. And then I put the potatoes in, you know, sort of at the started low and then just went right up the tower. And then when it's time to harvest them, you can, and they'll come, the leaves and so forth, the plant comes out the sides. And then when you want to harvest, you just unroll the screen.
I'm going to have to try. See, this is what I love about what I get to do, Larry, because, you know, we as gardeners, we try some pretty, a lot of non-gardeners look at us like we're crazy, but you know, that sounds like a great option. We tried to grow, we read an article that we could grow 100 pounds of potato in a 2 by 2 square foot area. And we, put some soil and then you kept building the bed up and harvest. And it was a lot of work for what we got out of it. You know, but it was one of those, okay, we tried it. It didn't work for me, but it works for others, so that's a good thing. And so now you'll have to let us know if, Josh, if this, you know, works, because I'm thinking I might have to just set up a little area in my garden to give that a try, Larry. Thank you for the suggestion.
It's pretty good. It actually worked pretty well. Now, I didn't get 100 pounds of potatoes out of that, but I got a lot of potatoes, and it was fun.
That's true. Part of why we garden, right?
You mentioned Ruth Stout earlier, and I was thinking about some of the old videos that are, I could still find them online of Ruth Stout and her garden, which are absolutely, they're kind of hilarious in a way, but I mean, she'd say, well, now I'm going to go out and plant my garden. And she'd go out, and there was a big pile of mulch or refuse or whatever, and she'd kind of lift a little of it up with her hand, and then she'd throw a potato piece in, and she'd say, well, that one's planted, and then she just kind of...
And she always was wearing a dress, too, so just pointing that out. Not like me in my old overalls and looking pretty ratty. So.
Well, the other thing that she did mention one time, of course, this was never in the video, but she said she really appreciated and enjoyed gardening in the nude.
Okay.
It's not a picture you want to have in your head.
For anybody surprising me with a visit, you don't have to worry. I may not look well, you know, I may have ratty jeans on, but they're covering me. So she was a character. In my blog I did for Milorganite on no-till gardening, I have a link to one of the old videos I found, because you're right, they are informative, but very entertaining. And,
yeah. Well, your own videos are informative and entertaining as well, and you got a bunch of them.
Yeah, we try to do audio, video, written tips, trying to meet, you know, we all learn differently. We all want to access our information differently. And sometimes if you can see it, it makes it much easier than someone explaining it. So thanks. Yes, we like to keep those videos coming, and always looking for topic ideas from gardeners, what they want to know, whether it's a webinar, a presentation, or a video.
And you got a bunch of those coming up. Well, you've done a few, or quite a few, and you have some more coming up, some presentations and so forth.
You bet. Next week, I'm on the road a little bit, not too far from home, but I'm speaking at a couple of different places, including FC Johnson, the Golden Rondelle, on, you know, water-wise gardening, dealing with droughts and floods. I'm also at Pasquazi Garden Center in Lake Bluff, Illinois, on Saturday doing a demonstration and talk about pruning. Time to get out there if you haven't. I started on a few things. They're starting to get to the point where I need to finish up quickly, but, you know, always something to do in the garden, which is good.
Melinda Myers, our guest today. Melinda, of course, a nationally known gardening expert. If you haven't had a chance to look at her website, melindamyers.com, you should definitely take a look at it. And, of course, her many, many books, including my favorite, The Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. I'm Larry Mueller with Melinda Myers for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for spending some of your day with us. Back with us, Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host. She's an author and a columnist. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along here. She'll be with us right till 12:30. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And Mary and Toma is on the phone, so let's go there. Mary, hi, thank you so much for calling.
It's great to talk to both of you, and I admire both of you. I wanted to retell one of my favorite stories from Ruth Stout's book.
Good.
And it's about her corn cage. She had a big problem with raccoons eating her corn, so she made a cage, a chain link cage that had like a cement foundation around the perimeter. And it cost her a pretty penny, I'm sure. And a city slicker came one day to visit her and see what her garden methodology was all about. And he said to her, well, how can you justify spending so much money on a corn cage? And she looked him in the eye and said, how much did you spend on your last vacation? And he told her, and she said, this is my vacation. I got a big kick out of that.
That's wonderful.
And that is what we do, isn't it? When we go out in our garden, it's our vacation.
And you had a question or an issue, Mary, didn't you, to deal with?
Yeah, it's the same old story. I've been lasagna gardening and loving it for years, and I always get that tomato blight, that late one where the bottom leaves get yellow and they fall off, and I don't know what to do about it. Should I just live with it? I usually get good tomato plants from, you know, a good nursery, like dung or whatever.
Yeah.
I get it regardless.
One of the questions I have is, there's one disease called Septoria leaf spot that has the leaves turn yellow, starts at the bottom, and they have more angular dark brown spots. And then the leaves drop off. You still get fruit, but it's the ugliest looking tomato by the end of the season. The blight problems, there's an early blight that, you know, the leaves turn yellow. You get larger, usually a lighter brown spotting. The fruit can be affected. It usually doesn't kill the plants immediately, where late blight does. That's kind of like, wow, you got it, the plants are gone, and they're dead. So I'm guessing you either have Septoria leaf spot or early blight. as far as I know there, last I checked, there weren't any Septoria leaf spot resistant varieties. There are some early blight and even late blight resistant tomatoes. Check All America Selections. They've got some that they mention. And then just even doing an internet search. I know Extension, UW Extension Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, Brian's written a couple things on blight on tomatoes and lists some information that'll be helpful. You know, you're doing lasagna gardening. I'm guessing you probably mulch the soil, so that kind of helps keep that, you know, the fungi in the soil, so it's less likely to splash up. Some people will remove the lower 6 inches as their tomatoes get bigger so that it reduces the risk, the splashing up and infecting the leaves. If you don't mind using a chemical, there's some organic copper-based fungicides that when you treat at the first sign, realizing that the plant may already, the next batch of leaves may be infected. So even though you sprayed, you might still have disease showing up on some leaves because they were affected but not showing the symptoms. So it's not that you failed, it's just you got it too late. And so fungicides traditionally are preventatives. So those would be some things. Septoria leaves, and you're probably doing all the right things. Good airflow, proper spacing, caging or staking your tomatoes so that they've got better airflow, reduce the risk of disease. Those are the environmental things we can do to reduce the risk. And then rotating. So if you have space, you know, if you grew tomatoes, peppers, or eggplants in that lasagna bed, grow onions or beans in that bed next time and move your tomatoes to some other place. Even though I have a lot of space to garden, I grow a lot of tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants, and a lot of cabbage and broccoli. And so I'm always struggling to rotate my crops so that I don't follow season after season, just to have to, you know, trying to reduce the risk. In the city, I move my tomatoes from one end to the other of my little garden or in a pot. So that was the best I could do. But good soil, and you're doing that, your part for that, Mary. Good soil means healthier plants, and they're better able to tolerate the disease. So you might want to check to see if it's Septoria or if it's early blight and then make a choice. Do you, like you said, live with it and you still have plenty of fruit, or do you decide to do some mulching and hope that you could improve the environment? It may not be possible. You may be doing everything right. And then, you know, spraying as a last resort and looking for something organic if you choose to do organic versus synthetic and fungicides.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Christopher and Madison, what's on your mind?
I bought a bag of meal organite fertilizer, and my neighbor said, oh, you're using that Milwaukee sewer sludge, with a snide remark. Is it safe to use that on my vegetables and my trees and my shrubs?
So I'm going to explain to you, I'm going to share with you where some of this is coming from. And I do work with Milorganite. I used the product before I worked with them because I like it. It's goof-proof, low nitrogen, 85% organic matter. So about 40 years ago, there was a problem. It is the byproduct of their wastewater treatment system. So all the solids are eaten by microorganisms, and then it's kiln dry. If you ever see that the plant's open and you're in the area, it's very cool because it's just not what you expect. Very clean, doesn't smell. So they basically test daily and weekly, and it's pathogen-free. But about 40 years ago, there was a cadmium plating company that was discharging into the Milwaukee River. They cleaned up that problem, and so even though the heavy metals were below the federal standards, they opted to take edibles off the label. But that's been cleared up. So it is labeled for use for food crops and ornamentals. I choose to use it on everything. Some gardeners prefer not to use the byproducts of our wastewater treatment on food crops or at all. So that's kind of why we garden, right? We put down what we want. The other concern that's come up is those forever chemicals, the PFAS, that's in cosmetics, it's in foods, it's in a lot of products that it's not even labeled that it's in. So obviously, if we're eating it and we're passing it, it's going into our waterways and such. Milorganite is below the federal standards and below main standards of PFAS allowability. And they are working with legislators across the country, like other sewage sludge companies, water treatment companies, because we need to get those out of the products that end up going into our waterways. And I know there's some new recent legislation being passed or was passed in Wisconsin about PFAS and in our drinking water. So that's kind of where you get some people are going back 40 years, and some garden writers, I'm afraid to say, don't check the dates and the current data, and so repeat that. So the heavy metals are not an issue. PFAS is something that you may have read about some concerns. And again, I choose to use it on everything. That's a choice I make as a gardener. So, you know, what are we going to do with that stuff, too, is the other thing. Yeah. You know, we've got to find a place, and soil's a great filter, but you've got to be comfortable using it. So I use it on everything, and I just like to give gardeners the background so you can make a decision yourself about whether to use it on your garden and landscape. So thanks for the question, Christopher.
Yep, thanks much, Christopher. Sue in Union Grove, we'll go to you. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry and Melinda. I love the show. I listen to it every week. And I've heard Melinda speak several times. But I'm just wondering, I heard you mention Roundup for your crown vetch. I also have a really bad case of crown vetch. And I was wondering about a different chemical. And if you know about it and if it's more selective for crown vetch other than the Roundup, it's called Butyrac 200. Or herbicide 2,4-DB?
Oh, good question. I'm glad you mentioned that. So one of the problem with any 2,4-D products are the broadleaf herbicides. They are selective in terms of broadleaf plants. So if you're spraying it in your lawn, for example, and you've got grass growing, that's a way to go because it'll kill the broadleaf weeds, dandelions, plantain, you know, the crown vetch, but it won't kill the grass. In a garden setting, you don't want to use it because it stays in the soil longer, and it will also be absorbed by your good plants and can kill them. So you want to use broadleaf weed killers very selectively because of their staying power. Back in 1995, I'm kind of showing my age, we had a bad drought, and I know a lot of farmers were using herbicides. And then the next year, they applied the normal amount, and they were finding some herbicide damage. And part of what was discovered is that because it was such a dry year, a lot of that herbicide didn't break down, wasn't absorbed by the weeds, and so they ended up with excessive amount of herbicide that damaged some of their crops. So always read and follow the label directions. You know, you'll find me, I'll open that little thing that's taped, that little booklet taped to the back, because it tells you what crops you can put it on, how much to use, when to apply. So one of the other things, I want to give a plug for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They have great information on invasive plant management. And I did a webinar with them, and it's on the Milwaukee Public Library YouTube channel on creating a beautiful garden free of invasive plants. And I had two of the members from DNR with me to answer questions. But they have a great website. So I usually go like, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Crown Vetch, and that's how I get to the Crown Vetch. And it tells me all my different strategies and timing and products. So the cultural methods, the mechanical methods, and if you choose chemical. And that's a great place for those invasive plants you're battling. So good information and very helpful. So you might want to check that out. But I would read that label, and if you're applying it to a garden, I would be hesitant because I think it's going to stay in the garden and kill your good plants if you're planting things other than crown vetch. Mowing, regular mowing can help. I managed it on a hillside after 3 or 4 years of regularly removing it, but it got away from me in another part of my landscape. So I got a battle with it this year.
And Sue, if you are into it, like me, you might purchase yourself a magnifying glass.
Oh.
One like Sherlock Holmes, if you're
to read the label,
to read the whole thing. I mean, some of it I can, but then the type gets smaller and smaller. And
You know, I always joke about my readers, but I think there are times I still need my readers and a magnifying glass. That's a great point. I wasn't sure where you were going with that, Larry. I'm like, why is she not looking for bugs? To read the label. That's great.
Oh, that is always in the kitchen and in a little cupboard, and I pull that out more often than I wish I had to.
I hear you.
Thanks, Sue. Patty and Eden, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi. So this is going back to your tomato planting. I find that even if you buy them from reputable nurseries, sometimes they already have blight in their soil without knowing it. So when I plant them, I mulch them immediately and then just water through the mulch the very first day.
Well, mulching is such a great option, especially if you wait for the soil to warm up. You know, if you're one of those, it sounds like you do that, Patty, so that's great advice. Thank you. If you like to plant early and the soil's cool and you mulch, you're going to keep it cool longer. So that might be where you warm things up, plant it, mulch it right away. So thank you. That's great advice. And the organisms are out there just waiting. So whether they're coming in with the soil from the nursery that sold it to you, or it's already in your soil if you had that problem in the past. So thank you for sharing that, Patty.
Yeah, appreciate it, Patty. Thank you. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have two things. One, responding to the woman who called in earlier about having received burlap bags and wondering
what
to do with them. A number of years ago, we got burlap bags and coffee chaff from a local coffee company. And we found that the burlap bags are sewn closed. The end is sewn closed with a synthetic thread, which does not decompose. So we would remove the thread and then just put the bag down double layer in the aisles of the rows between the rows in the garden to keep from getting to keep the paths from getting so muddy. And it worked really well, and then over time they gradually decomposed and went into the soil. And the other thing is another Ruth Stout story.
Okay. And thank you for that tip on the burlap bag. We can
yes.
count on your listeners, Larry.
And about Ruth?
About Ruth Stout. Her garden was at some distance from the house, kind of along the edge of their property, bordering a road. And her husband said that he could always tell. Larry mentioned earlier that Ruth liked to garden in the nude. And her husband said that he could always tell when she stopped gardening for the day and was heading back up to the house, because the traffic along the road stopped slowing down as they went past, and they were just traveling at a normal speed.
Oh, that's great.
And yeah, that garden was pretty. Her garden was pretty close to the road. Oh, man. Thanks for that story. Gosh. Gary in Milwaukee. Let's try something else here. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, well, that's a tough act to follow, but I have a question about Roundup. I have a big pine tree in my front yard, and I want to kill all the weeds and everything else under that pine tree with Roundup. But this pine tree has some very large, exposed, woody roots. And I thought that Roundup only works when it contacts the green part of the plant, and I'm not talking about any green part of this pine tree. But I'm just wondering if I spray the ground underneath that pine tree and that Roundup encounters or gets sprayed onto the woody roots that are exposed, if you think that would damage the pine tree.
You know, there's been some discussion about Roundup's impact on the soil, as even though it breaks down so it's not absorbed by the plants via the roots. And the age of the roots that are exposed, if they're able to pick it up. You know, I know people that do apply it and use it that way. I would probably try to err on the side of, you know, if you can follow out, you know, where those major roots are, maybe trying to avoid it or limit it. I haven't read the label lately on Roundup to see what it says in terms of using under trees. I know it's used quite often around trees and under trees. They've seen some problems on young trees where the bark is very thin. Usually the roots near the surface are fairly heavy and thick. I always erring on the side of that tree would be hard to replace. You know, maybe even, I didn't have a lot of success. I bought one years ago. They had one that was like, you could apply it like a deodorant thing where you could wipe it on, and I got too much dirt. Somebody told me they did the tongs of death where they put sponges on long-handled tongs that they only use in the garden, dipped it in the right concentration of Roundup, and then wiped it on the leaves. Now, you may be going, that's too much work, but if you can anyway minimize the amount that's going on the plant, I know there's an overspray for junipers using Roundup as well, where, you know, if the weeds are over top, but again, check the label directions for sure. I don't know, Larry, do you have any? I just would be really careful. I think you should be safe, but I'd rather, if, you know, erring on the side of caution, you don't want to hurt your tree. So maybe try wiping it on, you know, with the sponge or an application like that, so that you're just getting it to the weeds and not, and minimizing the risk to the tree.
Yeah, I agree. Gary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda, your Beauty Outside the Door program with public libraries, Wisconsin Public Libraries, is running again April through June?
You bet. And I forgot to mention that earlier, and I'm so excited because who better to partner with than the public libraries of Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan, though everybody, because I know you have listeners outside the state, are welcome to join. So we did our first webinar on Wednesday on containers throughout the year, and there's a handout that lists all the plants. So that's housed on the Milwaukee Public Library YouTube, but there's a link from my website. So go to melindamyers.com, look on the on-demand, webinars on demand, and then you can find the handout. And I'll be doing one in May on ornamental fruits and vegetables, and in June on underappreciated pollinators. And we have activities and videos accompanying them. So when we did our webinar on Wednesday, we had West Bend and Edgerton libraries had viewing parties, so that was kind of fun.
Cool.
They were hosting, and a lot of libraries do really, you know, the libraries do cool things. You know, they have book lists, they have activities, other seminars. So check it out. Ask your public library how they're participating, or just visit my website, and there's a link on there to all the information you need. This is our fourth year teaming up with the public libraries, and I'm so excited and appreciative of We Energies, who's sponsoring it, that it allows us to do that. So we're getting the season kicked off, so whether you have a small garden or a big garden, we've got ideas to help you along the way.
Well, it's a great program, and thank you for doing it. And thanks for being with us today, Melinda. It was a great pleasure, and I'm hoping that you'll come back and do this again.
I like chatting with you and your listeners, Larry. Thanks for the opportunity. And everybody, enjoy the growing season. It looks like we're getting started here hopefully soon. So.
It's supposed to be 75 in the Madison area on Sunday, so there you go. Melinda Myers. Yeah, Melinda Myers, our guest. Her website, melindamyers.com, and again, Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S, although if you spelled it another way, it would probably still pop up, melindamyers.com. Looking ahead to Monday, our physical therapists are back. We're going to talk about neck pain and, of course, take your other physical therapy questions. That's Monday from 11 to 12:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots in store right through the afternoon on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.